custodians of the planet, acknowledge and pays respect to the past, present, and future traditional custodians and elders of this nation, and the continuation of cultural, spiritual, and educational practices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. You are with Custodians of the Planet. I'm Denise Yildiz. Custodians of the Planet brings consciousness to planetary challenges and looks at different perspectives regarding the tensions and harmony of human activities in a changing climate.
It is not easy to learn how to live with a climate crisis, and many of us are concerned about how we can personally affect change. Many of us have been protesting fossil fuels, changing diets, biking activism, and even very personal ones, childbearing decisions. Recent studies have found that in many countries, there is an increasing trend of young people factoring climate change into their reproductive choices. It's been on my mind to do an episode on climate change's impact on reproductive decisions, but it's such a delicate and intricate topic. So I've been observing, listening to friends and their friends, and scrolling on Reddit for hours. After the last episode with Leslie Head, she suggested I talk to Yadina Tenkel, who has been very gracious with her time and is joining me online today. Yadina is a human geographer and interdisciplinary social scientist. She is currently conducting research called Emotional Weight of Babies for a PhD in the School of Geography, Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Melbourne. Previous to this study, she has worked extensively in the areas of urban poverty, food insecurity, gender-based violence, and health inequalities. Welcome, Yadina. I'm glad to have you on the show.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
This is a very interesting and topical research, and I'm curious about how you ended up studying it. Can you tell us a bit about your journey?
I guess it's been a bit of a long journey. As you said, I've sort of had many incarnations around my research. I actually got into this type of research looking at Zika, sort of the assemblages around Zika and the issues that were coming out a number of years ago in mostly in South America around the impact on reproduction and reproductive choices. So this is sort of an extension of that, kind of a culmination of the things I'm interested in around inequities, around the ideas of multiplicity of crises and how people are placed in those situations.
I guess it's a great timing to study it.
It is. It's funny. I started this work specifically in 2018, and there wasn't as much done about it in terms of research or data. But I think post-pandemic, I get told by many people how timely it is, including my neighbours in lockdown. All of a sudden, we're like, oh, we kind of understand your research now. So yeah, I think there's a timeliness to it, but I'm quite intrigued in that mainstream timeliness that people all of a sudden seem to understand what I'm talking about after a few years of working in this space.
There have been many factors influencing women's reproductive decisions. You've mentioned your research looks at a number of issues around precarity and reproduction and babies. Can you define what you mean by precarity?
I use it in quite a loose umbrella term. Uncertainty could be another word that might be used a bit better. So if we want to take it out of kind of academic discourse, maybe uncertainty would be a better word. So people really grappling with decision-making processes when things are so uncertain and unknown. This kind of idea of climate change or the impending apocalypse, and we don't know what's on the other side. And how might we situate babies, these material beings, into such an uncertain space? So for me, I'm actually more interested in that discomfort that you talked about at the beginning. It is uncomfortable. It's kind of sticky and makes us kind of squirm. So I'm curious about why we're so uncomfortable about it and why babies are really put in this kind of vector to look through the climate crisis.
Yeah, it is somehow quite unsettling. What kind of emotions are surrounding this uncertainty?
Oh, I mean, there's so much, you pointed out, there's so much now done about climate and emotions, which is Fantastic. So there's a lot of grief, anticipatory grief is another one that's coming up quite a bit. The emotions I'm mostly interested in is around guilt and shame. Mm-hmm. So I should probably position myself. I am a white settler academic in Australia. My family came as refugees, but I am a white settler woman living in here in Australia. And so a lot of the people that I have interviewed come from the same situated place. So their decisions are made in a particular context. And a lot of the discussion that people talk to me about is feeling guilty for wanting children, the shame of having children with the knowledge of climate change. So I'm sort of interested in those edges rather than that more mainstreamed documenting around grief of not having children, which has sort of become a bit more mainstreamed.
Do you think this shame or guilt comes from society, or is it like an internal dialogue that causes it?
Both. Potentially, but I'd say from the people I've spoken to who have had children, even though they would say that they are aware of the climate crisis, you know, that sort of big umbrella, it would be, yeah, I think an internal thing. Like we're all constantly making changes to adapt to a changing climate. It's always been changing. It's kind of constantly changing. And I think it sits with a lot of issues around morality that people are starting to talk about. Is it moral to have children with so much uncertainty and uncertainty of a particular scale? I think people are really terrified of the scale and enormity of the climate crisis. It's almost like none of us will be able to escape it, is how people are articulating it. So, yeah, I think the guilt and the shame of wanting children, of having children, of how to raise children comes into that as well.
Does this apply to heterosexual women or monogamous couples or to the entire gender and sexuality spectrum?
Look, that's a good question. And that's one of the biggest critiques I've had of the research that's been done. And a lot of the research that has been done, the sort of authors or the sort of researchers will say, you know, we need to look at more diverse people. But if we take, so as you said, it's all over the media. There's often articles about someone's not having a child because of climate change. And there are a number of assumptions made in those statements, which I think answer your question. Is one, that our bodies are capable of having children. So assumptions around fertility, that it's easy to make a baby, that, yeah, heterosexual, generally white, able-bodied, of a fertile age. That's kind of where a lot of the rhetoric and discourse has been situated around those bodies. And then if we go to the other side of the spectrum, if we take it from sort of a very more critical feminist perspective, there's a lot of work being done around diverse kinship and, you know, the work of Sophie Lewis around the family abolition, of looking at babies outside of a monogamous relationship. So there are lots of ways to make babies. There are lots of ways to make families. There's lots of ways to parent or care for children. But a lot of the research misses those components, for sure.
I mean, in my personal life, I do have friends who wants to explore having a family in a, not necessarily in this nuclear model, but yeah, having a baby and growing baby with the community, which... Mm-hmm. It's in the theory it sounds good, but in reality it's been challenging for them. So
well, I think that's the critique that a lot of feminists in the sort of anti-population space as well talk about, that again is a white settler construct of a nuclear family. So maybe it's the nuclear family we need to be looking at, and an idea of ownership around babies, that particular people get to own bodies of babies. So this idea of mum and dad, nuclear family, and looking at more kinship models. So if we were to argue, and I'm not saying that I would, that we need to lower our population levels because of the climate crisis and, you know, scarcity on earth, that's sort of how it's framed, that argument can start coming into it for sure.
If you don't seek a partner who is an ideal father or mother material, I wonder, how does precarity affect what we want in a romantic relationship?
Do you mean what kind of precarity? You mean with climate?
For example, they're going to have a relationship unless they both agree to have babies, but now the baby's out of picture. So how would that affect people's interaction in romantic environment?
Oh, look, I think that's an age-old thing around desire to have children. Yeah, I think it is. I would say maybe people are talking about it earlier because of the climate crisis. People are sort of, there's more of a literacy around that as a factor in decision-making process. So, yeah, I don't know.
That's interesting. Good question. Who would have thought uncertainty affect our romantic desires and relationships?
Well, I mean, it probably does. If you think about uncertainty in a number of ways, you know, this sort of idea of a traditional monogamous heterosexual relationship in sort of a, maybe we take somewhere like Australia, around insecurity and uncertainty of housing, so price of living. So I think those discussions are being had anyways. But yeah, babies is a big one for certain, definitely.
Yeah. In comparison with other generations like boomers or millennials, Generation X may have quite different views about reproduction and its challenges. Have you noticed any thought or ideological differences between generations in your research?
Do you mean in relation to climate?
Yes.
Yes and no. So I think that it depends, because I'm taking people at a snapshot in time of where they are in terms of their reproductive journey, right? So if we think of a reproductive journey, it could be over a lifetime in terms of sort of fertility as well and what our body is capable of. But if I were to talk about boomers, they're looking in retrospect for what they were thinking back when they were at an age of reproduction. So there are. I think that there's an assumption that it's a new conversation. It's not. I've spoken to many people who would sit in that sort of baby boomer category who said they thought about these things a few decades ago when they were looking to have children. So I think it's the scale of the discussion and how mainstream the discussion is. The Gen Xers that I speak to, probably the discussion is more around how many children. So many of them are at the end of their reproductive journeys of deciding how many children to have in a family. Millennials, I would say there's a difference between old and young millennials. I'd say the older millennials have been grappling with it. So they've probably sort of come around the age of deciding to have children when that climate literacy has been much more sort of embodied and available to them. You know, I think about some of my students who are early 20s, who they'd be, what are they, Gen Zs? And they kind of laugh it off. So I thought they'd be like, we're not having children, you know, because of the climate crisis. But I actually think they seem somewhat laid back, and it's possibly because they're not thinking about reproduction at the moment. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of research, though, that says, you know, I think it also depends. So a lot of the research being done is by environmental activists. So people really actively engaged in climate movements or in ecological and environmental movements. So there's a lot of work being done with younger activists who say they will not have children because of the climate crisis. But if I think about sort of, you know, my average kind of student who wouldn't identify themselves as that actively involved, they kind of go, I don't know, I haven't really thought about it.
Which yeah. Makes sense, I guess.
Yeah, so I do think there is definitely, when I speak with people, the emotions attached to it are quite different. A lot of the baby boomers or sort of just older generation talk about grandchildren and how that's also shifting their identity and their view of self when their children tell them they won't be having children, and how they sort of saw their lives being played out as grandparents and that identity being taken away from them. A lot of them describe it as that if their children tell them they won't have kids because of the climate crisis.
Yeah, so it sounds like it has this rippling effect. This one decision.
It does. I mean, think about babies you know or babies in your life. They don't come in just into a house in a room with, you know, this idea of two people. There's a community, and not even talking a familial community. But if you think about it, all these apocalyptic films that we see where there are no children or no babies, babies are scarce. It does affect our sense of place and space, that sort of seeing children running around, children being a part of our streets, of our sort of public spaces. So I think it does affect all of us in some way.
Absolutely. They have a really bright energy and can be exhausting, but it can be fun too.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right.
And you mentioned about activists telling or claiming that they won't have babies. Do you think there's this persona or like character is evolving? If you're an activist, then or people feel a bit more guiltier because they think they're an activist, but then the majority of activists is just like making these bold statements. Do you think there is like kind of a persona in that?
No, I don't, because I've spoken to a lot of women who are actually pregnant, who are full-time activists, environmental activists, who said, I never thought I'd have a child, but here I am pregnant and having a child. So, deliberately having a child. So an active decision to conceive. Some of them have talked about at first feeling a little ostracized or not sure where they fit in, but then they've really latched onto a lot of activists of an older generation who have said, we grappled with these same things, these same issues, and they're trying to, I guess, formulate how they'll parent and how they'll bring children up in the world. So they've kind of shifted into a different space of how they nurture and raise children with sort of the knowledge of our ecological state.
And we talked about generations in a broader sense. Climate disruption or climate crisis, as you said, is not the first crisis or factor that influences reproductive decisions.
No.
The first thing that comes to my mind is the innovation of contraception. That has changed the world in terms of the population dynamics at many different levels, both socially and culturally. In what ways do you think climate change is novel or different in the ways that it affects people's reproductive choices?
I think it is different. I think we're framing it differently. I think we're framing it as a crisis. And I think crisis is the word that I'm really fascinated in. So if we think about racism, I would say, is racism a crisis, right? We seem to be able to live with racism. There's no urgency to, you know, sort of fight racism or this kind of clock that we feel with climate change, the crisis, the impending doom of it. So I would say if we take uncertainty or if we take sort of those big ideas around climate change and we transfer it to a different crisis, I don't think it has the same global attention, or it's not looked at in such an empathetic way with a timescale attached to it. So you think about people who are asylum seekers or refugees, these are crises that we're having. It may not affect all of us the way that climate change is framed to affect all of us at a different scale, obviously, but we're all on this planet and we're all in relation with each other. However, yeah, think about people fleeing war-torn countries who have no idea if they will ever be settled somewhere to call home having children. So I think these decisions are being made every day in different contexts. So that's why I'm quite interested in this idea of the multiplicity of crises and how they can sort of be layered. Because if we think about climate change and the climate crisis, not as this sort of singular thing that has led us to there, right? It's layers. So that's how I try and look at it, that idea of a multiplicity of things. And if we think about how we make a decision, so how do we make decisions? I don't believe there are a light bulb moment. We make them within our social context. We make them within the context that we're in. We make them from our own life worlds. There's so many things that get to a point where you kind of decide which way you're going to go. You're weighing things up. You may not have access to certain things which impact your decision. So that's sort of even just that idea around reproduction and choice. Not everybody. So you can't have choice if you don't have access. So that's sort of the big critique now around reproductive rights movement. You don't have access, you don't have choice. And so that, I would say, could fit within the climate crisis as well.
I guess the injustice or the inequality is again playing into in the climate crisis and, you know, having access to all these resources.
Totally. I mean, we don't even have to go that huge. There are people in Australia that don't have access to basic needs. So that idea of uncertainty and precarity, it can be an everyday lived experience. It doesn't have to be that big impending Armageddon. So that's why I'm really fascinated that we're so interested in reproductive decisions under that big sort of what's on the other side, we don't know, the big abyss, when people do live in that state of uncertainty already.
Oh, it's a beautiful topic.
It is. It's a beautiful topic, but I mean, there's no answer. I'm not going to give you the punchline at the end whether you should have children or not. I think it's messy. It's emotive. It's sensitive, as you say. But I think it's funny because whenever I do a lecture or I'll give a presentation on my work, and people, it's almost like people want to say to you, you should put a trigger warning at the beginning of this. And I think, man, there's so many topics that need a trigger warning. Like, I'm sure your own work needs a trigger warning. So, but there's something about babies, there's something about the fleshiness, the materiality of them, that we find so uncomfortable. The innocence of children, they're innocent, you know, it wasn't their choice to be brought up into this world, all this kind of rhetoric. But it's all of this work outside of babies is really sensitive and emotive work.
Yeah, even when I was drafting this episode, it took me a while to just like put the questions and I could even feel the weight on just like making an episode about it. So. Well,
you know what? I love that you've used the word weight, because that's actually the big thing I'm really interested in is metaphors in this context and the metaphor of weight. So that's what I'm really, if we sort of take it out of if we take it more to the discursive level, I'm fascinated with the metaphor of weight. And I use that really to guide my research of how we talk about weight in the climate crisis. That's why I say the emotional weight of babies, the weight of burden, how some babies weigh more than other babies. So which babies are we talking about lowering numbers of? Which babies is it moral to have? Is it the lighter babies or the heavier babies? Because not all babies weigh the same when they're born in terms of things like the weight of racism, the weight of genetic disorders, the weight of ableism. So I think you've really hit it, that idea of weight. And even when you said it, because we're watching each other in video, you sort of had this embodiedness of heaviness. And I love that, because that's what animates my research, is that heaviness. Mm. Yeah, and how some babies are going to be framed as too heavy.
I also really trying to harvest the potency of metaphors in my research, because language is so limited sometimes, and then you just use this metaphor and analogy and then everything just falls in places.
It does. I think it's really fascinating, but it also, they're used for a reason. So if I look at sort of some of the content analysis, the metaphor of weight is used a lot. So a lot of this sort of discourse from critical feminists who are pushing back against anti-population narratives that there are too many people on this planet, that we should not be having so many children, really look at those ideas of choice and coercion and how the language is going to start shaping ideas of which babies it's moral to have. If we believe that there's not enough resources for all of us.
Yeah, it's a really tricky one, and it could be really messy.
Well, it is, and you know, and history tells us it will be. So that's another thing, like this idea, a lot of work within the feminist sort of reproductive justice space is around the idea of coercive reproductive control. This is not new. This will be history repeating itself. So that's the real concern of many critical feminists, is that we actually need to start talking about what it might look like if we are incentivizing people to have less children, the argument to have less children. Who are we talking about? Which bodies will be having less children? Which bodies will not be born?
Yeah, I guess also so the academia can be really white, and you know, people of color is also hopefully contributing to this discussion and putting their work in there.
It is, and they are, but I think again, that's, you know, it's funny because when I speak to people, it's also people talk about this in a sort of really everyday way, that idea of guilty, like, oh, you know, I know that we're the problem for the big, you know, we're the biggest emitters, carbon emitters, so we should have less children. It's not really people from the global south, and I'm fully aware of that. So I think a lot of the guilt and shame when I speak to people comes from that idea or that notion. But it's, you know, they still have children, so I don't know.
We just briefly talked about, there have been many interesting opinions, and it's, as you said, it's a
day-to-day conversation, you know. It's mm-hmm. we talked about the weight of babies, but they also come up in day-to-day conversations. And I guess I've heard so many interesting arguments from different people. I also read about it. What are the different lines of thought you heard or engage with? Can you tell us a few?
Around babies and climate change? Well, one, too many people on the planet. Yeah, that's the big one. The population conversation, that's been going around for decades, though. It's not new. So it's immoral to bring more people onto a planet where species are dying. So that's that sort of sits under that sort of idea of the Anthropocene or anthropogenic climate change, that humans are the problem. We've caused it, so we need less humans on the planet. And there are feminists who sit in that space who agree with that, so some in the sort of techno-science space. So that's one line of thought. The other one is the ethics and morality of bringing children into the world and what world they will inherit, when we know of the sort of, we don't know the scale of degradation and decline, but we know it's happening. So that's another line of thought. So that's sort of some ideas around that. Another one is people saying, hey, I'm going to raise a climate warrior, so my child could be the one who gets us out of this mess. I hear that a lot from white middle class people. That sits in an unusual space for me personally, because I think that's that idea of intention and virtue. I think I'm not sure that a white baby is going to get us out of this mess. My cynical side, it's
too much of a responsibility to put on someone who doesn't have any decision to come to this world.
That's right, exactly. And I'm like, your baby could be the next Elon Musk. He's not going to get us out of the crisis, right? It is, and that. But I do wonder, of the babies being born now, sort of in this generation, of what legacy or what burden they're going to inherit. You know, we talk about, we're not, you know, it's not my generation that got this, it's my parents' generation who got us here and my grandparents' generation. But now, if we're, like you and I, actively talking about this, so people are thinking about it and saying, well, you know, to hell with it, we're going to have children anyway and we're going to raise them in a way that doesn't, that impacts positively and might be a part of the solution or part of, you know, what gets us out of it. Yeah, what will that be like growing up with that? That's big, eh?
It is.
That's pressure. It's a lot of pressure.
And a lot of pressure and expectations.
Expectations, but I wonder if that's guilt, and if that's that unsettling feeling that people are having around their decision. Which for some people, I would also preface to say that this is a new feeling for a lot of people, and I think that's that idea of precarity and the people think it's kind of a new feeling. It's not new for everyone. So there are, you know, tonight there's going to be a lot of people going to bed tonight not knowing where their child's next meal's coming from, and the stress of that. I think it's a new actors are emerging to talk about precarity, because life has been precarious for many in many different ways for a long time.
Yeah, and we talked about crisis, and so, you know, I'm fascinated by fires, and that's a temporal crisis, I guess, that freaks out everyone in summer and then goes away.
Yep.
But what about, I'm thinking about the past, what about like a nuclear war? Do you think, would you define it as a crisis, and that would also have this huge effect on people's decisions? Have you read any literature around that, or different kind of crises you've seen?
Yeah, I have thought about it a bit. It's almost not, and you know, it's not like a nuclear war, but people talk about COVID. Mm-hmm. So COVID babies. I hear COVID babies. Oh, my little one's a COVID baby. And I think, I don't really know what that means. It's sort of, or Pyrocene babies is another one. So sort of this age of the Pyrocene, or there's, you know, there's really good research being done out of ANU around the bushfires and reproductive decisions related to that, and sort of, and also, and the impact of smoke in utero and what that was like in that sort of, you know, the more recent bushfire season. So I think those conversations are definitely being had. I personally don't think it's shifting the demographic numbers greatly in terms of people deciding or not to have children, because, you know, people still are having babies, and babies are still celebrated, which is fabulous. So I don't think we're seeing this sort of massive demographic shift based on these crises. But I'm talking about when people make an active decision, when they're able to make an active decision, rather than sort of the physiological effects of these crises on people's ability to reproduce, which obviously a nuclear war, you would assume there might be some implications on our biology or sort of our physiological capacity to conceive.
When we think about COVID babies, then maybe they just think people are just putting a mask on.
It's talked about isolation, so that the babies aren't used to being around people, masks, and not being able to have sort of that, you know, babies learn by mimicking, by especially smiling and laughter, sort of sadness. They're sort of emotional regulators for babies. But then again, I say, well, you know what? Again, babies are born during war. Let's look at Ukraine. You know, this young children and young babies going through the horrors there, and their lives are different, and how they relate to people or how they're isolated from people. So it is happening all the time, and babies are still being made.
I guess, yeah, because it's a drive that we want to reproduce, like some humans at least, I guess.
Yeah, it can be. And it's funny because, you know, if you say to someone, why did you decide to have a child? So I often talk to people who have decided not to have children, not specifically because of the climate crisis, just sort of more in general. And they say people are so fascinated to know why they made a decision not to have a baby. But you rarely say to someone, why did you decide to have a baby? It's always, so the norm is to have a baby. So think about it. Like, someone has a baby and you know, you usually say congratulations. You don't say, oh, why did you decide to have a baby? Tell me what you wanted a baby or what emotion. But, you know, a lot of women who don't have children, who are childless or child-free, they say they really get quizzed on why they don't have children.
That's a really good point, actually. It's definitely a thing.
And I think that one of the, you know, sort of, you know, in research, when sort of someone gives you just this little nugget and then you go along with it, is one of the sort of more interesting things that has come out is a lot of women who are child-free by choice have said that, you know, they'll be at a bus stop or at the supermarket and someone's chatting to them and says, oh, you know, you should have children. Why are you having children? You know, someone's sort of getting into their personal information, and they'll say, oh, it's because because of the climate crisis and we're all doomed. And so they're actually like, it's a great, like, how do you respond to that? How do you argue with that? So yeah, a lot of the women I speak to are like, yeah, it's a really great way to get people to back off if you say that, because how do you argue with that? Rather than, you know, it's, some of them are like, I don't like children. That's my reason. But that's not as palatable than saying it's because I've thought about it in terms of the climate crisis.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really interesting one. Yeah. Are you interviewing these people? How are you collecting data? Or are you bringing in focus groups? How do you bring the discussions?
Interviewing and, yeah, so one-on-one interviews and focus groups, yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And I think it's this thing of, even if we think about asking people that idea of the social context that you come in, if we think about a reproductive journey, so many things come into it. So people talk about this idea of relationality. People talk about other people in their lives. It's not just about the person that they might want to co-parent with, if that's the situation that they're in that sort of dual parenting relationship. A lot of people talk about, yeah, sort of impact, other impacts in their lives that have brought them to these decisions.
So we talked a bit about the feminist critiques, and obviously I haven't done much research yet, but I've read along the lines something like these comments or arguments about reproductive choices coming from white male voices. Mm-hmm. What do you think about this? Is this true or not true?
Historically, yes. If you go back and read like the population bomb and all these kind of really, and yeah, historically I would say yes. But now, no, women, there are women who are doing this work as well. Yeah, I would say it's sort of more across the spectrum now, but it's certainly a particular type of maybe conservative, white, middle class discussion around it. But now it's funny because, you know, the discussion now is because of the pushback against anti-population chat, because of the really insidious history around eugenics and coercive reproductive control, people are now starting to say more than one child.
Really?
Yeah. Again, that seems, because that's more, you know, you're saying, oh, we're not taking people's right to have a child away. We're saying just don't have more than one child because of, you know, sort of that carbon legacy of children. There was a study done in 2017 that still talked about around lifestyle changes that you can make, and the best one you can do in terms of carbon or CO2 emissions is not having children or one less child. So you can change your cars to, you know, sort of hybrid or electric. You can change all the light bulbs in your house. You can recycle, but nothing's going to impact it quite the way as having one fewer child.
Yeah, and when we're talking about these things, these are all on an individual level. But imagine if we had this big political shift, and, you know, if we experienced the paradigm change, which won't happen overnight, and that would, everyone could have their babies in whatever number, but still this neoliberal ideology imposed on individual, and it's like we feel pressured somehow because we're trying to carry the burden, and, you know.
Yeah. I think, but I would argue that, you know, as you said at the beginning, my background is more in sort of the poverty space, and I've done a lot of work in familial poverty or sort of intergenerational poverty in sort of Western industrialized countries. And think about how many times people talk about, oh, I drove past the food bank and there was a single mum with five kids. Why she got five kids? She's just doing it for the money. She's just doing, you know, sort of this happens already. So this sort of critique of how many children someone has is happening daily. It's just shifted to who we're talking about. So those discussions are already had around limiting people's choice around how many children they can have or should have, because one would argue that those children of a single mother at a food bank are a burden on the system, a burden on the welfare system. So that's already happening. Yeah,
I'm just thinking a situation where it's the opposite, like I think it's in China, and maybe in other countries as well, maybe in Nordic countries as well. If you have more than two kids, you've been supported by the government or you get some sort of an incentive.
Yeah, it is happening in some places, and that is to shift demographic trends because of the aging population. So, yeah, if we think globally, it's happening in certain places, but then reproductive, yeah, family planning is really being pushed in other places in the world.
As you said, then it's just really contextual, really up to where you live and who you live with, your life circumstances. And
well, I'll give you a really interesting example for me, and it's something that I'm really fascinated in and sort of trying to follow, is this idea of, let's think about climate and the uncertainty, this idea that we're not yet at the Armageddon. It's like a cliff and we don't know what's on the other side. So the argument by academics, particularly an academic called Michelle Murphy, she talks about we're already in the Armageddon. A lot of people, the Armageddon is here. Maybe not for everyone. So there is no uncertainty. The Armageddon, the hell, is already here. Many people are already living that hell and experiencing it. But if we think of this idea of we don't know what's on the other side, so if we think about Pacific populations, this idea of sinking islands, how do you bring a baby into that? Where do babies fit into that, right? So we're riding, populations are also being ridden off. This idea that there is no hope for places, there is no hope for people because of the climate crisis. So what is that? How is that going to impact people's reproductive decision makings when that rhetoric is so grand and so large? But in reality, a lot of the scholars who are working around climate adaptation are saying, we don't know. Maybe we can adapt. Mm-hmm. But babies have this sort of a time scale, a time frame on them. If you think about milestones, we think about sort of milestones. Babies are a really easy one, you know, 6 months, 1 year, sort of to work things through. And that's how I see the climate crisis being framed in 2050, in 2030. You know, this is what the sort of the temperature rises are going to be, and this is how it's going to be unlivable by this year. But if you think about someone deciding to have a child, they can say, well, you know, in 2050, my kid's going to be 20. So what does that mean? So I think there's something really interesting there around how we frame time scale, that sort of chronological time scale around the climate crisis, and how you might fit a baby into that idea, and which populations we're sort of okay to write off.
Mm. when you were talking, I just thought about this. Firstly, we are in the climate crisis. We think like we're just waiting for the edge, but actually we're in it. We're in it, yeah. And maybe we're not experiencing it, you know, the human societies, but the biodiversity loss, and there's so many things that are happening maybe we're not even aware of.
Yeah.
So just within that precarity and uncertainty, when you say bringing babies, I see this like beam of light just coming into it, and whether that's going to be part of the adaptation or, you know, without putting any pressure on the new generation. But, you know, it's quite complex.
It's really complex. And I think reproductive decisions are complex in themselves.
Yeah.
Right. It's not a decision, you know, and I think we need to, I am talking about decisions here because not all babies are made through decisions. There's, you know, sort of unintended pregnancies as well and coerced pregnancies. But if we talk about decision-making, the decision to say I'm actively deciding to have a child and I can actively sort of create a child, whether that's biological or not, or create a family, I think it is complex. And I think people do, whether they articulate it, think about their decisions, we say it's sort of made with your history and your social context and your desires, the family you're in, all these kind of other factors come into it. And I think climate should be a factor and is a factor because, as you say, we're living it. We're living in a changing climate. Same as, you know, we're also living in Australia where people will not be able to afford a house. You know, people, you know, I speak to young people and they say, I'm more worried about never being able to own a home than the climate crisis in relation to children. So that idea of security. So if we think about this idea of ontological security, this kind of idea of your identity and sense of self or sense of place in the world, climate for some people sits along these other kind of factors in which they decide. But for some people, and a lot of the work is done, as I said, around climate activists, that's the big overarching, you know, the argument is, well, there's, you know, you don't need to worry whether you can get a mortgage because there's not going to be, you know, houses aren't going to exist. We're all going to be in gas masks or whatever your sort of apocalyptic image is don't worry about the housing market. Yeah. So I think people are grappling with a lot of issues, and climate is certainly one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we can put the housing maybe into a crisis, housing crisis. Yeah.
The housing crisis. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Totally.
What about the COVID-19 pandemic or bushfires? Have these made this a more pressing issue for people, or has it affected individuals' reproductive decisions?
We sort of touched upon it a bit before. I think I don't know, with the COVID one, there are studies coming out. It feels temporal. It feels like people delayed the decision making. But, you know, that sort of thing, we're kind of, at least, you know, where we're speaking from, that sort of, we're sort of out of that sort of, it's almost like you're out of the fog and out of the haze, and things seem, if we just think of COVID-19, life is kind of getting back to a semblance of normal. So I don't know that people are factoring it in as much now as maybe they were in the sort of the thick of that real feeling, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, when we had no idea what was going on. We didn't even know how the virus was spread, and it was just that impending, is it going to be like all those movies that show that sort of contagion epidemic, you know, epidemic. Personally, and maybe there's research to differ to what I'm saying, but I haven't seen a huge amount now.
What about fires?
I think it would depend on the communities that you're in. I'd say communities that have been very adversely affected, sort of proximity to fires. Yes, probably. But look, you know what? I think if we think about it in another way, there's a lot of work that came out of the United States looking at Indigenous communities and communities of colour that are positioned around toxic waste sites. So we think of that as a crisis in itself, and the impact of that on even just our ability to reproduce, so on our fertility because of the toxicity. So that's already been happening. So bushfires and sort of the physiological effects, that there would be an effect on people's health because of sort of respiratory things that happen in bushfires. So there has been work done around that already. So the argument would be that people have been, their reproductive, that sort of ecological reproduction nexus already exists, but it may not be articulated or have been teased out quite to the degree that we tease out climate change.
I guess then the same could be applied to floods and all other disasters.
Yeah, I think, though, there is this idea of, as you say, that temporality of crisis, this sort of, you know, it's almost like when I talk to people and this idea of like a 2030, 2050, and then what? What is on the other side, right? So as you say in your work of the temporality of a bushfire, it's going to happen again. We know it's going to happen again, but there's almost a reprieve. There can be a reprieve from it. There can be a reprieve from a flood, reprieve from COVID-19, even in between the sort of lockdowns with the sort of different mutations of the virus. There was a moment to breathe where you could go, oh, I feel like myself again and I understand my place in the world. The climate crisis is slightly the sort of, I'm talking the big climate crisis and that sort of big bubble is a little bit different.
Yeah, because the fires and the floods, everything is part of the crisis.
Exactly. It's there's so many things. Like we were talking about, you know, when we first got on about how hot it is today and it like unusually hot. But then, you know, in Melbourne a month ago, we were all wearing puffer jackets because it was so cold. So it's we're in it, we're living it. And if it's not this, it's this. And if it's not that, it's that. So there's so much that comes under the climate crisis, which is probably why it feels so enormous. And it is a temporal crisis, but we don't know when it's going to end. What does it look like at the end? Can we fix it? Can we solve it? What does it look like on the other side? When are we out of it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, it is a really big decision.
Yeah.
There's so many parts of it.
It is, but you know, like I suppose it sounds all very dire and doom and gloom, but also, you know, babies and children bring people, a lot of people, hope and joy. And so there's sort of that flip side that I think I'm not saying that babies are the answer to that, but finding hope and joy amidst the crisis, which sort of has to keep us going, right? I don't know. I'm quite cynical. I find I don't sit in the sort of hope category usually, but yeah, my work is situated in a school of geography, earth and atmospheric scientists. So there's a lot of that doom talk around the science, the actual science of the climate, right? That's not my field, but they know the science, and that's pretty scary stuff to know that in implicitly what the science is telling us, or you know, what we think the science is going to tell us what's going to happen. But then someone will show a picture of a baby and everyone goes, so do you know what I mean? It's uncomfortable, it's unsettling. I've also been in lectures or I've given talks where someone's pregnant in the sort of Zoom chat, they say, I feel really bad about, I'm sitting here and I'm pregnant and I feel really guilty. I've seen that a lot in Zoom chat. So I think, you know, I think with lots of things we need to sit in the discomfort and not run away from it and have tricky conversations.
Yeah, and I guess having a discomfort doesn't necessarily mean it's the wrong. I mean, there's no right and wrong, but having the discomfort doesn't mean we're on the track that we shouldn't be on. It's just the part of the process.
It's uncomfortable, but I do think for a lot of people that's a new feeling, and I think that's why we're seeing so many books come out about climate emotions, because as I said, if we take racism, just the emotions around growing up in a world where a baby is born into this world and it's already marked, we already, you know, they're already heavy in that burden, that there's legacies of racism and colonialism, there's sort of ableism, of gender, whatever you want to sort of put on it. Some people have never experienced that at all, those ideas of heaviness and uncertainty, and there's probably a privilege in that. So I think that's why we're seeing just a burgeoning of people trying to process the enormity of these emotions around uncertainty.
Before we wrap up, my final question is, if any of our listeners are unsure about having babies, and you said you're not going to prescribe anyone, but do you have suggestions on how they might interrogate their decision-making options?
Oh, as I said, you know, and I tell you where that comes from. Well, one, I would never tell someone what to do, but I you know, you said your last podcast was with Leslie Head, and I once said to her something like, oh, you know, you would tell me if it's not good to have a child because you know the science. She knows the science more than me. And she said, okay. And she said to me, I would never tell someone whether they should have a child or not. And the more I work in this space, I would, you know, I don't know. That's the honest answer, because I think people are making these decisions already. I think it's like anything. If we're talking specifically about the climate crisis, I would say start reading more widely beyond the climate crisis. That includes how we parent or nurture children and the world that they come up in. Yeah, I really, it's a tough one. You know, if you ask me my personal opinion as girlfriends or, you know, as friends, yeah, I'd quite happily sit and dissect your decision. But it is so unique to people. And I think that's sort of one of the missing pieces. It's so unique.
I really appreciate your answer. I think it's great instead of just like, these are the things and these are the steps you need to do. But, you know, everyone is on a different journey.
Exactly. And I've given presentations and I've had emails saying from people saying, oh, can, you know, we chat afterwards. And then on Zoom, they're like, so I've been really grappling with whether I should have a child, and almost to sort of counsel them through it. And I think people want me to say that it's okay to have children. But yeah, I don't have an opinion on someone else's reproductive decisions. I think I would say the best advice I can give, which may be so abstract and so peripheral, is to look at some of the tenets of reproductive justice movements. So this is moving away from reproductive rights, moving towards reproductive justice, where we look at creating a world where women, I'm going to talk specifically about women or feminize others, have a choice to have a child, choice not to have a child, and we look at the environments in which the children are born into. So I think that has really helped me to look at reproduction more broadly, look at children more broadly, and look at how we might support children that are already on this earth more widely beyond just an ecological crisis.
And maybe also creating a culture where all journeys are supported and all decisions are supported and celebrated in their own way instead of judging or critiquing or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to social workers which is another sort of work I used to work in, but for this project, around when a baby is born to, say, a mother who is on welfare, so people would argue can't financially support their child, and they've said they've seen midwives and their, you know, social service workers really, when a woman has told them I'm pregnant again, they're just like, why would you do that? Really not being extremely judgmental around a child rather than being joyous. So that already happened. So I'm really interested in critiquing that as it is. So I think it's a thing with the climate crisis of saying it's a large scale kind of window onto these microcosm, these sort of micro interactions that we have already, this disconnect from sort of the more than human world, our disconnect from nature, our disconnect from each other. I think if we look at reproduction in that and reproductive decision making, I think it's really going to expand the way we can talk about it to be less uncomfortable.
Yeah, Dina, thank you so much for your time. This has been a great episode that I loved our chat.
Oh, my pleasure. And it is such a nice way to start the year to get me back into my work and to go what it is. It's been really, really enjoyable for me too. So thank you so much for having me.